Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast and our Superintendent Series. This podcast is brought to you by Toro. Those big agricultural tractors you see working on golf courses, with their clutch and complicated lever pulling sequences in a turf maintenance application, they're like stepping onto the first tee not knowing which swing you have that day. I think we've all been there. Toro's new Outcross 9060 can do everything those clunky tractors can, but with tons less stress on the operator and, most importantly, on the turf. With automotive controls and programmable attachment parameters, even rookies on the crew can be trusted with aerating, top dressing, mowing grass, loading sand, and removing snow from around the clubhouse in the winter. Unfortunately, it is that time again for us northern folk. The Toro Outcross 9060 is like having all of your best golf shots saved, ready for use each and every round. Follow at Toro Golf on Twitter and reach out to your local Toro distributor to schedule a demo. This episode of our Superintendent Series features Culver Military Academy Superintendent Michael Vesely. Michael has been at Culver a few years now. It's a little-known nine-hole course in central Indiana, but it is one of the best nine-hole courses in the world. Very few people know about it. The play is pretty restricted. It only people that can really play it are alumni, faculty, and students at Culver. Michael has been working on this Langford Moreau course for a few years. And recently, in talking to one of his crew members, he learned about some old tee boxes. So Culver was originally planned for 27 holes by Langford Moreau, but you know they built nine like they did with many courses back then. And now this has led Michael on a little bit of a historical deep dive looking for remnants of the other holes that could have possibly accompanied these tees. So I went out, it's about 2 hours from Chicago, and Michael and I walked around the woods for a couple hours looking for greens, tees, found something that might look like a green. We'll see if we can find out more in the future. But Michael, we talked about his career as well as Langford Moreau, maintaining Culver, and the historical dive that he's on and what he's uncovering and the whole process. So without further ado, here's Michael Vesely, and I hope everybody had a happy and safe holidays.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
What when you were a kid, what subjects were you best at in school?
Math, for sure, and yeah, it was probably my best one. And science as well.
Science,
yeah,
that makes sense for turf.
Yeah, yeah.
Were you good at history?
I was interested in history, for sure, and still am. But, I guess it wasn't one of my best subjects, but it interests me.
Now you find yourself immersed in a historical deep dive, huh?
Correct. Yeah. It's been interesting.
So you're at Culver. It's a famous military school, world-renowned, and it has nine-hole golf course, Langford Moreau, that relatively untouched, pretty much untouched, except for a couple things, maybe. Restored, you came in mid-restoration, but tell us a little bit about the last couple of weeks and how you've gotten on. You've found some tee boxes.
Yeah, the last couple of weeks, like I said, have been interesting. I was, we were out cutting up a tree that had blown over. And there's a gentleman that works here that's been employed with the academy for 35 years. And he just nonchalantly mentions there was a tee box underneath our current maintenance building. And, you know, I looked at him puzzled, like, you know, what are you talking about? And he's like, there was a tee box I used to mow until they built the new maintenance building, along with a few others that are out on the property, which got me to looking into what else was out there. And I've recently started digging into the old, it's called the Vedette. It was the Culver Academy publication that's been ongoing since the late 1800s. And just looking at articles to see if there were other holes that were built or what else is out there. So it's taken me on an interesting trip so far.
Yeah, the Langford Moreau plan, they designed 27 holes for the military academy. It's long been believed that they only built the 9.
Correct.
And so you've been diving in. What have been the interesting, I mean, one of the beautiful things with it being in a school is the paper.
Exactly.
Not a lot of courses had this their own, like, essentially publication.
Right, right.
So you've started to read. What are some interesting things that you found that maybe push you one way or push you the other way?
Yeah. I've gotten to as early as 1921, where golf was becoming popular in this area, according to the paper. It was the new sport from Europe, and was catching on. They called it. I've read a few articles where they called it the golf bug was catching on, and Culver's is proud of its athletic prowess and fielding a lot of sports and athletics, and they wanted to get into golf. So there was a lot of talk in the early 20s, obviously, of a golf course. They used the Max and Cucky Country Club is what it was called. Then it seemed like, from what I've read, they used that to play golf from time to time. Now, it wasn't a set schedule or anything. They just would call up local schools. They even played Notre Dame for many years.
The university.
Later on, they would just play the freshman Notre Dame team, but they played the University of Notre Dame golf team. They played Valparaiso University golf team, I've read. It was just, you know, the sport was catching on, I think, and it grew and grew. And Culver always wanted the finest for their cadets. And that's where the Culver family decided to build the golf course. I mentioned to you that they found three firms that were drawing up plans for the course. Now, I've yet to find out who the other two firms were. Obviously, one of them had to have been Langford and Moreau. So that was an interesting tidbit I found. The other thing was there's not a lot of mention of extra holes after 1924. Until you get to 1932, where there was a mention in an article that they wanted to expand the course to an 18-hole course. So originally 27.
Quite the time to be considering.
Yeah.
18-hole expansion.
Right, right. Because, you figure the Depression. I know enrollment was down after the Depression, but, you know, there's a mention in an article of expanding it then. So, you know, those are probably the most interesting things I found so far. Now I'm just getting into it, so there's a long way to go to figure out where these tee boxes came from, why they're here, and if anything else was ever done.
Obviously, the golf community, I think one of the amazing things that Twitter's done is for your profession is that it connects you with all these different people. Talk about a little bit how Twitter and the ability to, you know, you had conversations with all these people that have been either that can relate to this or lend expertise in different areas for this. So talk a little bit about, you know, who you've connected with and where, how they've kind of helped you push you into certain directions on your kind of history hunt here.
Yeah, well, Twitter has been great for me personally for agronomic reasons first. I was not, you know, an architect junkie before I came here. I was more into turf than architecture until I saw this place, and it piqued my interest. And obviously, being here, a lot of people have in that arena have contacted me because they're interested in Culver. So it has lent itself to a pretty big network of architect fans and people who are well more equipped at digging into history than I have. Now, I have connected with Sean Tully at Meadow Club via Twitter. And then we spent 5 days at it was called the Superintendent's Retreat, Mindfulness Retreat. It was at Prince Edward Island in Canada. And him and I were both selected, so I was able to spend 4 or 5 days with Sean in a beautiful setting, and we talked a lot, not just about golf, but a lot of things. But you know, one evening he broke out his hard drive with all his findings he had, which was just incredible. But since in the last couple of weeks, you know, interest has perked up in what I'm finding out here, and we had a very good conversation this past weekend. He's coaching me on how to do things and where to do things and where to look, and so it's been he's been a great asset in this journey so far.
What type of stuff has he been recommending? Because obviously you're at the beginning of this. What type of research methods was he suggesting that you might not have thought of?
Well, one good thing, as you mentioned, is we have an archives here at the Academy. So that I'm lucky in that respect, is that I've got all these newspapers. Plus there are things over there, communications between Culver and whomever we may be looking for are over there, along with photos. So the paper is a good start. And then the photos and everything else that's at our museum is going to be another deep dive. But one interesting thing he mentioned was to find photographers that took pictures back then. He has found out there a family that has been in photography since the 20s, and the family's just carried it on. And he would find photos with the name of the family at the bottom, and then he would contact the current family members and say, hey, do you have photos from, and they, at first they didn't think that they did. And Sean showed them a picture of I think it might've been Cypress that had their name on it. So they looked into it, and sure enough, they had photos of golf courses back in the 20s. So that was an interesting idea, to find out photographers and if there's a family lineage of photographers still around. And one interesting thing, the other interesting thing was to go to, postcard shows, to find people that have postcards from, you know, and he's like, you never know where it leads or where it can go. I mean, he's made connections that way. So, it's going to be interesting. I'm looking forward to digging in a little further.
So next step is to get really deep in the archives.
Yeah. That's the next step. And, you know, you can track down some, I've mentioned Irv Nelson, who was the golf pro here in the 20s, to try and track down his family lineage and see if there's children around that may have some things from then. And, you know, there's just so many ways you can go. It'll be, like I said, interesting.
Say you go down this rabbit hole, like what would be, you know, dream scenario for you?
Well, a dream scenario maybe to find a green pad, maybe. I really haven't thought that far ahead. It's more of a historical thing to find out happened when and what changed and why they, you know, I'm sure when I get, as I mentioned, when we get to the Second World War, that's probably when things were just like, you know, done. Mm-hmm. But I'm at a point now, like I said, with 1932 to the 40s, you know, what transpired. So, you know, more of historical reference for me now than I don't believe they'd ever expand the place or make another nine holes or anything like that. It's just more of a, you know, this is what I found, and you know, finding some pretty neat things.
You mentioned you weren't really into architecture when you got here, didn't know a ton about it. How is your, you know, you're really into turf. How is your turf, I guess, in presentation and style of maintenance changed as you've started to understand more about the history and the architecture behind the golf course?
Yeah, it's changed a lot. It's made me think more about the things we're doing out here. Looking at more, trying to present the course in the intent of the architect. That's where it's changed. I've definitely become more minimalistic in our approach. Trying to use less and just use what's here and, you know, maintain it to a high standard, but looking for more role, looking for more playing slopes instead of the, you know, 60-degree flop shot, to look at, you know, how can we maintain this area firmer? How can we improve our mow lines to bring in bunkers that were intended to be hazards for balls to roll into, which is that's been this past season was a big goal of mine, was to try and improve our mow lines to incorporate these plateaus that Langford built that are, you know, just amazing plateaus that have so many features that I want to enhance those features and just bring more of a ground game back to which was the intention of this golf course for sure when it was built, and you can tell, you can see the slopes and where balls were meant to go. So that the minimalistic part and trying to firm things up and it has changed a lot my philosophy on turf management for sure.
How have you gone, obviously you're a nine hole course, small crew, not the world's biggest budget. And, you know, the one nice thing, you don't have a ton of play.
Right.
But, like, how have you gone about the expansions? What strategy have you gone to achieve getting more width?
Well, we have the 1939 aerial, which helps bring in some lines. But, you know, I've talked to a couple people. Sean Tully's been one. David Normoyle. I've communicated a lot with him in the last year and a half about intent of mow lines, how greens that were built in the golden age were considered the head of the golf hole, and the approaches were the shoulders, which is why, not just the neck. So,
isn't it funny how everything got necked in?
Yeah, smaller. It is. It is. And it definitely... during the restoration, they widened the approaches out immensely, but they didn't bring the bunkers in that sit front and side of the green. So
that's such a good way to describe it, like the approaches,
yeah,
are the shoulders.
When David said that, it like was like a light went off. I'm like, I see it now. And
he's got like a really great way of describing.
It's fantastic.
He's one of the best communicators I've ever met.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I could show you the text message. I mean, it's just like, he says things, and I'm just like, that's perfect.
Yeah.
That's perfect. I couldn't say any better. And, like, the shoulders, I mean, the light went off. I'm like, I see it. I saw it. You know, I could drive around, and I say, I see what he means when he says that. And we were doing this when the U.S. Women's Open was at the Country Club of Charleston, mm-hmm, this year. So we were talking during that, and you could see a lot of, I could visualize that from that course, what he was talking about, the wide shoulders and the greens were just the head of it. So you want to bring all those characteristics into the whole. And as George Waters mentions, you don't want to separate good shots from bad shots. You want to separate good shots from great shots. Mm-hmm. So your ball will, which we saw at the President's Cup, it can roll, you know, if you're off, you know, a yard or two, it's going to go into a bunker, or it could roll next to the pin. I mean, it's just that was my intent of changing the Moy lines around the greens this year.
That President's Cup was pretty unbelievable to watch, right?
Yeah, crazy good.
I imagine from like a turf perspective, that was like a dream to watch.
Yeah,
you know, especially when you're starting to really believe, oh, I need to do this for the firmer and faster for these reasons.
Yeah.
And, you know, then you have this event that I imagine just affirmed your thoughts more.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And they, you know, no doubt they have an advantage with the soil conditions they have there and all of that jazz. I mean, that they can do those sort of things. Now we can get close to stuff like that. We're here at Culver, we're a heavy clay soil. So it's hard to dry it out too much because you lose turf when that happens. So, but it definitely reaffirms a ground game, more interesting, more fun, seemed like to me, to be able to play slopes and play angles and things of that nature to enhance the game and make it more fun.
Yeah.
I think for everyone, not just the best players, but I think that would be more fun for everyone. But one thing I noticed too while watching it is their mow lines and how they incorporated all their bunkering around greens, which was the intent of the bunkers. It was, the ball was, you know, a missed shot was supposed to go into the bunker, not roll down 3-inch rough and stop.
Yeah,
which is what we were dealing with here. So, you know, to see Royal Melbourne's bunkering and their close mode all the way around, you know, except on the back sides where they let the rough go, just kind of reaffirmed what we're trying to do here. So it was really fun to watch. And
there are some similarities. Like obviously Melbourne, the soil is completely different, but you know, you've got large undulating greens that have a lot of slopes around them that make positioning extremely, you can be in really good positions one day and really bad positions the next day, just thinking about the golf course. And I think it's obviously, you know, Langford and Moreau were, you know, their greens were severe greens.
Yeah.
And their surrounds were very difficult with big, bold bunkering,
right?
You know, and that, in a way, obviously the soils couldn't be more different, but the architecture behind them and the intent was very similar. In terms of technically, how have you been going about your fairway expansions? Like, is it a mow down? Is it a sod? How have you been trying to approach them?
Right now, it's just we've just slowly been mowing them down.
And you had bluegrass?
Yeah. I mean, we got everything out here. I mean, it's a hodgepodge of grasses. There's a lot more bent grass out here than I originally thought. So it's a lot of the area. I'm kind of just following where the bent grass takes me in some areas. But it basically what we've done is mowed them down. Slowly started sanding them, top dressing them more, you know, some growth regulators to try and promote the turf that we want.
Aerating?
Yeah, aerating more, overseeding.
Like how many times a year are you aerating the areas you're trying to expand?
Well, this was our first season, so we did them twice.
Okay.
And more sand. I mean, that's just as kind of simple as that, you know, just trying to firm them up, get the grass we want to grow going there. I'm trying.
So where you have this hodgepodge of grasses when you aerate and sand, you know, for the layman, what is it doing?
Well, we're firming the surface up, trying to get rid of the clay on top, basically, so we can get better drainage. and just to promote, it gives a good base for the bent grass that we're trying to promote. We've done it well on our greens. Our greens were never sanded for 80 years. So in the last 5 years, we've added about a 3-inch layer of sand into the profile of our greens, which has obviously firmed them up. They drain fairly well. And it's just a better environment for bent grass to grow. So that we're taking that same philosophy out to the surrounds and the fairways. So it's not anything big or extravagant. It's just it takes time.
Now for a quick word from our sponsor. Golfers get custom fit clubs for longer and straighter shots. Now using the adjustable technology on Toro's new Greensmaster 1000 Series Walk Green Mower, superintendents can dial in operator performance for precise, consistent cuts. The Greensmaster's telescoping handle has 5 different positions, so the operator's posture will be as perfect as a tour pro's, whether he's tall and skinny or short and husky. And the handle's rubber mounts have just enough cushion to prevent any hand movements from influencing the cut. Sounds like Toro's solved the mower yips. Maybe they can fix the putting yips next. Follow at Toro Golf on Twitter and reach out to your local Toro distributor to schedule a demo. Now back to Michael Vesely. Has there been any pushback from like the people that have played here forever about the expanded areas?
No pushback. Yeah. No pushback. It's and actually not a lot of people have even commented on it.
Don't
you
even
know?
Notice.
It's just you know, we get visitors from time to time that are into architecture, into Langford Moreau, that and they comment about it, how they'd like to see more of it, you know, expanded more, more short grass. But as far as like you know the school's team or faculty, I don't get a lot of feedback about it, which is one of the downsides to not, you know, those are the only people that can play here.
Yeah,
it was you know brought it. I questioned that before I took the job of what you know what was going to motivate me to keep going because I don't get daily comments about you know the. This was bad or this was good or, you know, that everyone hears. But, you know, it's just the feedback I really get is probably on Twitter and you know, from my visitors that come and play.
So, yeah, talk about that. You know, there's about 2,000 rounds a year played.
I would say, yeah.
That's high?
That's probably high.
Okay.
But.
So it's kind of one of the lowest played golf. It's, and for those wondering, I mean, one of the best 9-hole courses in the world, without a doubt. I'd put it up there with anywhere, but that's any 9-hole golf course. I mean, it's one of the best courses in the Midwest. Do you have trouble with motivation ever? Without having like you know that.
So far, no, because there's been an ergonomic challenge since I started. The greens were like walking on a mattress when I started. And people say that, you know, jokingly, but they really were. So,
and that was just from 80 years of no top dressing.
Yeah, nothing.
Just very spongy.
Very spongy. I mean.
Thatchy.
I walked on the fourth green, was the first green I ever walked on, and I was just like, oh my gosh, what's going on here? But, so there was the challenge of, you know, bringing those back. And they had just started expanding them out to where they are now. Mm-hmm. So we had a lot of thin areas and they you know, they just didn't look very good at that time. So that, you know, that was a challenge. And I knew it would be. And that definitely kept me motivated. And luckily the other members of the crew were just as eager to make it. To make it better. So, you know, we're at a point now where I'm pretty satisfied with the way our greens are reacting throughout the summer now. So, you know, there's just different areas that I get to focus on. Mm-hmm. I when I took the job, I assumed it'd be 10 years or so before it was actually, you know, where I thought it should be. You know, because they didn't reseed or redo the fairways. They redid a couple tee boxes, but everything was just what's been here for 100 years. So it was just going to be on us to make it fit what they wanted to do. So that's a challenge enough. And then, you know, I'm lucky that we focus on the boys season in the spring and the girls season in the fall. The summer's kind of slow here because of our summer camp. We have 6-week summer camp from about the third week of June to the beginning of August. So the course is closed during the week all day until they're done with their camp classes. So, you know, we get to have a little downtime in the summer, which is
what are unique. You doing those days?
We're here. I mean, we do our mowing in the morning, and then we you know, it's a 3-man crew, okay, and they're including me. So it's very busy to get everything done that we try to get done for 3 people. It's probably the busiest I've ever been, but it's not a stressed out busy. You know, you go from one job to the next. So it takes 2 of us to mow and roll greens every day while the other guys mowing rough or moving tee markers, or, you know, it's a busy time during the summer, but we just don't have a play that you normally would to get around. I mean, we're getting around most times. The kids during their classes are either playing this 4 holes, the 1 through 4, or they're on 5 through 9.
Mm-hmm.
So we always have a place where we can go and find projects to do and things of that nature. So, you know, we're not working around people, but it's still busy.
What were you doing before this job? What was what course were you working at before?
I was at Blackthorn in South Bend for 3 years as his assistant. I started out.
Is that private or?
It's a public.
Public golf course. Okay.
Yep. Yeah. Very busy. Very busy. I mean, you know, 150, 200 rounds a day. I started at a grow-in, actually, at a course in my hometown in North Judson. The course is called Chesapeake Run. It's still there. The owner of the golf course I grew up playing was building a course in my hometown, and I was I went to college for a year, didn't know what I wanted to do, so I just started working.
Mm-hmm.
Worked a couple odds and ends jobs, and he said he was building a golf course, and I'm like, all right, I'll help you out. I need, you know, summer job or whatever. So we started when they were constructing that, grew it in, and I just kind of fell in love with turf at that point. I mean, it just amazed me where it was and then what it went to as far as turf and greens. And so I just really got interested, really got intrigued by the profession, and just worked my tail off there. I stayed there for 2 or 3 years. Didn't have the title of the assistant, but that's pretty much what I was. The superintendent left after 3 years, and they just asked me to take over, so I did. And during that time, I went back to school, did the Penn State Turf, the online program, got my bachelor's degree. And then at the end of 08, 09, when the recession started, we had just, or the Chesapeake had just started building a housing development.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So
good timing.
So the golf course started supporting everything and financially struggled. And you could tell, I mean, you know, could tell. So I just started looking, you know, I got to find something, you know. But I had never been the assistant, you know, at a bigger club or, you know, so I always thought that I may need to do something like that just to see. And I was sending out resumes for assistance jobs, and, you know, the feedback was you don't have enough experience at other places or.
Even though you were the head superintendent at another golf course.
Right, right. And I, you know, and some people were like, you know, what are you doing? Why are you, you know, doing it this way? And I'm just like, I just want to get experience. I want to know if I know what I think I know, you know, and if I could do it at a place like that. And the funny thing was, is I got two interviews in 2009. One was at Augusta.
Wow.
For a turf position. And the other was at Oakmont.
Holy
with
cow.
John Zimmers. So I had a 9-month-old at the time, but we drove out to Pittsburgh and I got to interview with John and drive Oakmont and look around. They were preparing for the 2010 U.S. Women's Open then.
Uh-huh. That was probably like right when they were cutting down trees at night.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was during that. But that was, I mean, it was incredible. That was a fun trip. And then the Augusta interview was just on the phone, but I talked to their first assistant for a good hour and a half on the phone, who's basically the superintendent of the course, mm-hmm. Takes care of the maintenance. But and then I got an interview at Point of Woods as well with Ron Fox there, so there was a few people that understood what I was trying to do.
High end private clubs.
Yeah, yeah.
But then the local courses.
Yeah, there's not much movement. It's just not much movement around here. But Blackthorn, John Quickstad, who's the superintendent at Blackthorn, has been since it was constructed. You know, he wanted a good player on his team. So
yeah, hungry.
Yeah.
Eager to learn.
Yeah. Yeah. So I went there. It's a high end public. They hosted the Symetra Tour, the Four Winds tournament.
Did this fall in like leaving Oakmont? Was that something that you were seriously considering moving for?
Yeah.
And did this coincide around the same time?
Yeah.
And then a place where you didn't have to move.
Right. Correct.
Opened up.
Now, the housing market was pretty bad at that time. So considering all that, the job opened up at Blackthorn. And I, you know, I took it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think a lot of people would question,
right.
You know.
It was an hour drive from my home each way. So, which, you know, to me is a long way, but, you know, that I had to consider that. There was a time change, Eastern time to Central time.
That's so strange.
It's crazy, yeah. It is. Especially when you're working at 4:30 or 5 in the morning. I live in Central time and work in Eastern time, so 5 o'clock start time at work is 4 o'clock at my house. And when you had an hour drive, I was leaving at, waking up at 2:30 in the morning and leaving at 3 just to get to work. So it became sort of an issue after a few years.
Yeah, I bet.
I was, my wife said I was a walking zombie. Just because,
especially with a newborn.
And I had two kids at that time then. So
I mean, it had to make it hard on her too.
Yes, absolutely.
The hours have to be tough with kids.
Yeah, it is. It is, and that's what made Culver so interesting. But that was a challenge then. I mean, it was. The commute made a lot of it. I mean, if I didn't have to drive so far, it would have been better. I mean, we weren't burning the midnight oil at Blackthorn. I mean, mm-hmm. it was a pretty typical maintenance job, but you know, the drive and the time change and things like that made it very difficult, and that's where Culver came in for me.
So going from somewhere with like heavy play to here where very light play, you know, what was the biggest kind of shock in terms of the way you looked at your job there and like how much it changed?
Well, obviously it changed a lot. I mean, we're not working around people a lot, but I don't know if it was a biggest shock or just I don't know how to describe it really, just a relief from pressure. Not that I don't enjoy pressure of performing. But having a golf course like this, being able to try certain things without, you know, if we have a poor area or something, it doesn't really affect whether people are going to come and play or not. You know, it's just kind of a kind of my own laboratory.
Yeah.
Of trying different things in turf or in agronomy. So there was nothing really shocking of the change, but more of a stress level went down and the commute time went way down, and just a big relief, really.
Sleep went up a little.
Sleep went up, and you know, my wife got her husband back, I think.
Yeah, talk about work-life balance. I struggle with it personally. I think a lot of people do, and I think a lot of superintendents do.
Yeah,
because like you leave so early, and
right,
the days are so long in the summer.
Yes, yes.
So you know when you leave in the middle of the day, you're kind of leaving your job with stuff's still going on at
right.
your job. What? How have you learned over the years to balance it better?
The biggest thing I've learned is. And it might be cliche now, but it's just grass. And whether you're here 8 hours or 16 hours, it's not going to make that much of a difference, in my opinion. Now, I'm here. I don't have a greens committee breathing down my neck or the four members that are upset about it, you know, all over me. But to me, now work-life balance is a struggle for a lot of people, for sure. And there's question on what is that definition of balance. I mean, or whether you're at home or at work more or less, you know, I'm not sure where balance comes in, but, you know, it's not the end of the world to leave after 8 hours, in my opinion. If you can't get done in 8 or 10 hours, what you need to get done in a day, then, you know, might need to find another area to work at, because that's just my opinion.
Yeah.
I think, you can make it work and have a home life as well. I truly believe that. Now it may not be at where you're at. They may expect a little more, but I just think that, and it comes with age and experience, and, you know, you realize that, if an area of a fairway dies, that it, you know, it's going to come back. It's all going to come back.
It's interesting what you said about, kind of being your lab, no greens committee breathing down your neck. And I think a lot about architecture and golf architects, when they get to build stuff uninhibited, you know, it tends to be a little bit more wild, you know, a little bit more bold. Like you see, I think one that jumps to mind is Rob Collins became the architect and owner of Sweetens Cove. And he built some of the most audacious greens that we've seen in modern golf construction.
Yeah, and absolutely.
You know, you can say, okay, well, he didn't have an owner that he was appeasing.
Right.
You know, as a superintendent, I don't have a greens committee that I'm appeasing. You know, you report to the academy, the university, and, you know, that not necessarily somebody that's really, you know, day to day in the weeds on the grass, like in even club greens committees.
Right.
A greens chair is very, very involved in the grass.
Correct.
And where would you say that that's been advantageous for you as a superintendent?
Well, definitely advantageous in that you can try things that, you know, if they fail, it's not, you know, it's not going to really come back. You know, nobody's going to come and, you know, you're going to lose your job because this didn't work out this way, the way you thought. So being an educational institution is an advantage as well, because, you know, we're always trying to improve what we're doing here and trying different things. And environmentally or however, you know.
Historically, I imagine, too.
Yeah, yeah, definitely historically. I hardly ever talk about Culver Golf Course without mentioning the Academy and tying the two together, because the story of both of them is just fantastic. I mean, there's a lot of history and some history I don't know for sure, but I just, the stories you hear and things that I've read while researching the golf course have been fascinating too. So it lends itself to be more free in trying things as far like widening the fairways or widening mm-hmm. the approaches. I'm very fortunate, and I know this, so I try not to tell too many people about the job, but I'm very fortunate that I can do those things.
Yeah.
And I understand a lot of people can't, and I often share things on Twitter that I know people can't try or do, or products that they, you know, we tried to kill the POA on this fifth fairway this year. I know a lot of clubs can't do that, but I share those things hoping that, you know, if others can see what it does and how it works, maybe they can sell it to their clubs, you know, things like that. So I'll try to work with certain chemical companies, or, you know, I've offered Purdue University, you know, if you want to try something in a real golf setting, you know, let me know, contact me. We'll give it a shot, you know? So I'm trying to help out as much as I can, but I'm very fortunate that I can do that for sure.
What would be next on your list? Say you get done with all the fairway expansions you really want to do in the next, say, just 2 years. What do you have, like a checklist that you're working down?
Yeah, I mean, with the expansions, I'm trying to improve our fairways.
Yeah.
The hodgepodge has been problematic because of the amount of poana grass that we have in our fairways. The summer months, they struggle. They struggle a lot sometimes. So improving the desirable turf stands in our fairways is kind of, with the expansion, is on the list. I mean, we're, as I mentioned, we've tried a product that will kill poana in fairways. Talked about adding a top dressing program to the fairways, trying to get more sand, obviously, on them. But that's kind of my next goal, would be to get desirables, firm them up, and have them play the way they were meant to be played. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, obviously those are running into our greens and surrounds now as well. So it's kind of all tied in together.
You played a lot more golf this year than you had in years past, right?
Yeah.
What did that do to kind of from a professional standpoint?
Well, it's always good to play your course.
I remember when we met, you hadn't played very much.
Yeah. It had been
it was
a long...
like, what, 2016?
Yeah, it had been a long time at that point. And working at Blackthorn, I didn't get to play a lot, obviously, because of the commute and having kids and family and, you know, all those other obligations takes away from being able to play. But I made a commitment to play more. I just wanted to see how our course played, and I enjoy playing golf. I mean, I've started playing when I was 12 or 13 years old, so it's always it's always been there. It's just a time factor. And you mentioned work-life balance, and my wife was supportive of playing golf, you know, having time to myself and playing golf and enjoying the sport again. But it you see different things than you would just walking the golf course, for sure. You know, you see how things play. You can feel the ground, how, you know, where you might need to improve or remove something, or you can see actually, you know, what things you've done that are right. You know, I remember playing hole two, where we mowed down the face of the front bunker there, and my shot was short and left of the bunker, and I remember looking at that shot saying, I got to get it over that face, or you know, the ball's coming back down in the bunker. So I mean, that's where I think the intent of Langford was, mm-hmm. was you got to hit the shot right, or you're coming back in the bunker. So you know, seeing things like that, you can say, okay, that's, you know, I think we're doing that right, because if I'm thinking about it, then other golfers are going to think about that, you know, where to miss type of shot.
Yeah, talk a little bit about maintaining Langford Moreau. I know I was at Harrison Hills, which is another Langford, and I ran into the superintendent, and we were walked and talked for a little while, and he was telling me how difficult it was with the slopes, and just how much of a struggle, and how frustrating it was really for him. And we're talking about, you know, 2018, you know, struggling. And
yeah,
you think about what was it like maintaining in 1920,
right.
28,
right.
You know?
Right. Exactly. And you know, it is difficult. It's difficult to find the right piece of equipment to do it, if there is one.
And it's because of the steepness and the
steepness of it, the angle of the slope. Which is another interesting thing, is that got me to thinking, looking back on intent. And I read Langford's book that he wrote, the name of it, slips
it's like
my
the Chicago Green Section thing.
Yes.
From 1915.
Exactly right.
It was found by Craig Pratt.
Oh, really?
He found it in the Michigan State Turf Library.
The library?
His wife was getting her PhD or something, and he was like, honey, I need you to go into the archives and find this. Isn't that amazing?
That's amazing.
And he talks about it when we did our pod.
That's just amazing.
So yeah. His wife had to go into the archives.
Hey, I need this book.
And find this book.
Wow, that's a good one.
Yeah,
that, you know, and
that's incredible. I'll tweet that out.
Yeah,
it was part of this. It's a great read.
It's
quick.
It's I mean, it's fantastic. One of the things that caught my eye while reading that was how he knew in this area, or this area of the country, Chicago, around here, is that in the summertime, the clay soils get hard and they bake out. And you know, I start thinking about these slopes around the greens. Well, they would have baked out in the summertime here, mm-hmm. and they would have been brown and hard as a rock, and the balls would have bounced. You know, they would have diverted to where he wanted them to, as far as the slopes. So maintaining them is a different story. Obviously, we nowadays don't want brown dead grass on the slopes around greens. So what got me thinking about expanding and mowing them shorter was that philosophy that you wanted the ball to roll or bounce. So mowing it shorter became a priority. Now getting there has been interesting. We've yet to figure it all out, but we're getting close with fly mowers. Some of our fairway mowers can hug some of these banks, but they are difficult to maintain for sure. They're just so big. It's not only the angle; it's just the size of them.
Yeah,
and I remember hearing Richard Forsythe, the superintendent at Royal Melbourne, talk about. Their greens aren't really big. I mean, they're good size, but the bunkering and everything around them makes them seem bigger, which is true here, because
yes.
You could have a greenside bunker shot, but it could be 30 yards or 40 yards to get on top of the green. So that's the difficult part to me in maintaining them, is that they're not only steep, but they're just large. And it presents a challenge for sure. And it's just, you know, we've tried to, you know, rotary mowers, push mowing, fly mowers, weed eating.
Which one worked the worst?
I think the push mowing was the worst because I remember about breaking my ankle trying to, you know, trying to hold the slopes while pushing a, you know, out front rotary mower.
Have you seen those like Roomba like mowers?
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know how much those things cost.
Yeah, I don't know. Hopefully there's, I think we found something with these, with the fly mowers we're using, that we can get down to, you know, a half inch mowing height, which is, I think, about perfect for our slopes. It'll take balls where they need to go or where they're intended to go. So we just started doing that at the end of the year. So we'll see how it works out this spring.
So we'll get you out of here. You know, in terms of Langford Moreau, and obviously, you know, you said to me today, like, there's one point when you were first got out here, you're like, whoa, this is different. What amazes you the most about what they did at this property?
Well, what's really amazing, and I think it's amazing to most people, is how much earth they moved in 1922 with the equipment they had. You know, I've been looking for that photo of a steam shovel out here to be able to show you. But that, I mean, it's just
going to be in the archives.
Yeah, it could be there. It could be there. When they built the airport, I did read that they borrowed Culver's steam shovel to build the two runways. So I know there's one here somewhere. So I'm going to dig deep in that.
I wonder if it's still here.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. It very well could be. And that's what, you know, it's exciting about this direction I'm going, is finding things like that to see, you know, maybe it's somewhere around here. But that, you know, just the green pads that were built and how much they were built up, it just amazes me that they could do that then.
Yeah.
Obviously easier nowadays, but, you know, And I think that might lend itself to more Theodore Moreau, what he was able to do. And I don't know a lot about Langford after Moreau was passed on of his work. You know, I don't know if it changed or...
I think it's much different before.
Yeah.
Much more subdued before him and Moreau got together.
Okay.
And then the Harry Smead might have been involved,
yeah,
too. Which,
yeah.
There's just not enough information out there. I don't think anybody's, you know, Dan Moore's done a lot of research, but nobody's really dug into them like the way that Donald Ross has been researched.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. Without a doubt.
Alistair McKenzie, yeah. Or, you know.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Definitely because they were designing golf courses in places like Culver, Indiana, and not San Francisco or
right.
Monterey,
oh, sure.
Peninsula.
Sure, right. Yeah, big difference. Yeah, big
New
difference.
New York and Boston.
Exactly. Yeah, but they were really busy.
They
that's
were.
For sure.
They
did a lot of work. And, you know, unfortunately, most of it's been changed or gone, but it's, and it's Sean Tully will tell you the same thing. We need to find out more about them because the work they have done that's still here is pretty impressive, mm-hmm. for sure.
Yeah, yeah, it's neat. So we wish you the best on your historical deep dive. Hope it doesn't lead to too much frustration, dead ends.
Yeah, we hope not to. That's for sure. But you'll know when I find something for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, everybody can follow you on Twitter. Your handle's M. Vesely.
M. D. Vesely. Yeah.
M. D. Vesely.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a good follow. Good. Lots of information up there.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So, absolutely. We'll talk soon. And thanks for coming on.
All right. Thank you, Andy. Appreciate it.